It's always a pleasure to welcome back John Williams.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Start off today, you know, with your thoughts on the U.S. dollar. It's caught a lot of institutions and investors off guard with this strength. The United States is maybe relatively stronger than some of its trading partners. What's going on with the greenback?
Well, it's been very heavily manipulated and targeted by the Federal Reserve. Normally, when you look at a currency strength, it reflects underlying economic activity, political stability, positive trade circumstances, as well as relative interest rates and inflation. That's a factor right now. The dollar fundamentally should be bumping along bottom, not multi-year highs. What happened here is we had a banking system, effectively, that went through collapse in 2008. The system was held together by the Federal Reserve, the Treasury. They did whatever they had to do to keep the system from collapsing. And in the process, the Fed ended up introducing quantitative easing, which effectively debased the dollar. They're buying up a lot of treasuries and keeping the rates artificially low. That turned with in June, I think it was, of or July of 2014, when the Russians were active in Ukraine. The administration took some actions against specific individuals in the Russian government, but didn't announce any formal sanctions against Russia. But covertly, and it's fairly obvious that this was done, they took action to rally the dollar and to suppress oil prices, which would financially hurt Russia. You can do a lot with intervention, of course, at least on a short-term basis. From the Fed standpoint, they had to pull back from quantitative easing. They stopped expanding the quantitative easing and then started talking about raising interest rates. Well, if you want to rally a currency, all the central bank has to do is talk about raising interest rates, and that more than any single factor will tend to push a currency higher. So they got into a pattern here of jawboning. Oh, we're going to raise rates, we're going to raise rates, we're going to raise rates, and they didn't. They finally did in December of 2015. And then after that, at that point in time, they're going to have a series of interest rates going forward. And they cried wolf all year long. And each time they did, they were able to help prop the dollar, and they encouraged it with intervention. And they didn't raise rates again until this last December of 2016. And now they're talking about raising rates significantly in the year ahead. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think their bluff here is about to be called by the system. Because the Fed is really in an untenable position, that they had no way out of the crisis back in 2008 other than stopgap measures to keep the system from falling apart, but they never addressed the underlying issues such as the weak economy, such as the long-term sovereign solvency issues of the United States. These issues are going to be coming to the fore again in the immediate future, and I'll contend that the economy is never fully recovered. It's turning down anew, and you're going to be seeing very weak economic numbers in the next several months, which are going to put pressure back on the Fed to not raise interest rates, but rather to go back and provide additional quantitative easing in the system to expand that. And that should kill the dollar. But you have to keep in mind here that the quantitative easing, and again, you have to go back to the panic of 2008. The system effectively collapsed. They did everything they could to hold it together. And then going forward, they had to get some liquidity into the banking system. That's what quantitative easing was designed for. The Fed bought up the mortgage-backed securities to help provide liquidity to the banks. They also bought up treasuries that the banks were holding. But rather than let the banks take the cash that they're getting from those treasuries and lend them into the economy, which would have stimulated economic growth, the Fed had them deposit the funds back with the Fed as excess reserves, and the Fed then paid the banks interest on those excess reserves, all of which, again, funded the banking system, but not the economy. The Fed's primary function in life is to keep the banking system afloat. They had failed in 2008. They did everything they could after that to keep it going, to get it back on a solvent and normally operating basis, we're still not operating normally. You're still not seeing normal lending in the system. But the concern with the economy was secondary to the banking system. Now, you might say, oh, but they talk about the economy all the time. Sure. They use the economy as cover, political cover, for what they'd been doing in the quantitative easing. They knew that the public was tiring of bailing out the banking system. So say, oh, we're putting this quantitative easing forward to stimulate the economy. But it did very little to stimulate the economy. Bernanke knew that. He indicated that. But it was designed basically to bail out the banks. So it was a way of bailing out the banking system. And as we come forward here, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but we're seeing the economy weaken anew. You're going to see that coming up in numbers in the next month or two. And as that happens, I expect that market speculation, as it did last year after the one-time rate hike in December of 2015, is going to all of a sudden say, hey, the Fed's not going to raise rates here. And in fact, they may have to go back to quantitative easing because a downturn in the economy puts added stress on the banking system. And again, the Fed's primary goal here is to keep the banking system afloat. And if they need to expand quantitative easing, they will do so. That actually also helps the Treasury because it's going to have increasingly difficult funding needs. You don't have too many people outside the United States that want to buy Treasury bonds at this point. So it has multiple purposes. But in the process there, that will reverse the perception that the Fed's going to be spiking rates, and where spiking rates will support the dollar, debasing the dollar, which is effectively what they're doing, but the quantitative easing hits the dollar hard. And I expect you're going to see a very sharp decline in the U.S. dollar in the first half of this new year, enough so that you don't want to be in the dollar. It'll tend to spike inflation. Benefiting that will be gold and silver prices.
Exactly. But, you know, we've seen the People's Bank of China, central banks in Europe, the ECB and others, I think, in Scandinavia drop their lending rates into negative territory, essentially. I mean, with even the PBOC, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 3.75%. Don't you agree that it's really offered the Fed considerable wiggle room in their efforts? Can you give us the implications of this red hot, as at least it was recently, stock market that's caught so many pundits and institutions off guard?
You've had a change in political system here, which is working its way out in the early days of a new administration. If you look at the popular press in terms of what was going to happen with this election, there's no chance Mr. Trump was going to win. The problem is that despite all the hype and all the games that get played with economic statistics, Main Street USA has a pretty good sense of what's going on. And over time, the general public has voted its pocketbook more than anything else, enough so that you can actually predict changes in the political system. What you'll find is over time, and the consistent numbers here only go back to 1930, or say the 1932 presidential race, but every time that the annual real disposable income, that's a take-home pay adjusted for inflation, when the growth here has been below 3.1%, the incumbent party's always lost the White House. And that was a circumstance here. That was predictable. Mr. Trump picked up on the general dissatisfaction on the economy, the common experience, not the headline nonsense that comes out of the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That's what drove the economy, and that's why he effectively has some mandate to try and stimulate economic growth and turn things around. We'll see how things go. I'm sure you're going to see some forms of economic stimulus. The only problem with that is just systemic, and that is that any change that you make to the economy or try to make to the economy has about a 9 to 12 month lead time before you see its impact. That's just the way the system is. So that the stuff that's done now to stimulate business growth should have impact in 2018, not necessarily before then. So what we're going to be seeing in the next half, pretty much for the balance of the year, is going to be weaker than most people are looking at, and certainly weaker than what the Fed is hoping for. in terms of its hype, and it's basically just hype. I mean, they've talked recent years about how their primary policy is jawboning. They don't have any effective way of bringing the system back, and that's where hopefully we'll see some positive change with Mr. Trump and some pickup in the economy. Two issues here that are I see dooming the dollar in the year ahead. Number one is the befuddlement of the Fed, their inability to control the system, bring it under containment, and that they're going to have to fall back towards quantitative easing, which will weaken the dollar. The second thing is the budget deficit, and the actions taken by Trump will tend to widen the deficit in the near term. Once the economy picks up, assuming it does, then you'll have greater tax revenues coming in that'll help balance it out. But it doesn't address the long-term solvency issues of the U.S. government, which remain in place. If you go back to 2011, I think it was, when Standard & Poor's downgraded the treasuries, you had a dollar panic. But the long-term solvency issues were a major concern to the currency markets here. And as the deficit comes back into focus, I think you'll find the global currency markets are coming into focus again on the long-range insolvency issues. Right now, the U.S. government, in terms of net present value of its obligations in place and its long-term debt, needs something in excess of $100 trillion in hand today to cover its future obligations. There's no chance of that happening. I mean, if it played itself out over time, you would see generally, as Mr. Greenspan once expressed, hey, don't worry, the U.S. can always cover its debts by printing dollars. Only problem with printing the dollars is it gives you inflation and eventually hyperinflation. And that's what the rest of the world recognizes, that debases the currency, takes you down to zero. And it's why, as the sentiment shifts back to the U.S. dollar, again, being based on these extraordinary long-term deficits, that the rest of the world is going to shy away from the dollar again. Against the dollar is a dominant currency, no question, but it's also the dominant economy, the dominant financial system, and nobody has quite bankrupted our major economy as well as the United States has.
We've had a regime change now, of course, politically, and new administration. And, you know, when we saw this around the year 2000, there was obviously a blow-off peak from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party in U.S. equities. Intriguingly, around the year 2008, another regime change back to the incumbent party. You might say the pendulum has swung all the way back. Do you expect another peak in the markets, or is that just simply a paradox or an anomaly that we saw in U.S. stocks?
The regime changes have been relatively minimal in recent years. The people running both parties are not that different in terms of their general outlook. And when I talk about the general outlook, I'm talking about how they're viewing the U.S. Economy versus the rest of the world. We've had a circumstance since early 1990s, where the philosophy has been to move the U.S. towards some kind of a unified global economic trade system. That's when NAFTA was introduced. That's when the Maastricht Treaty came into play. And the general movement has been forward there, and all the push towards free trade has indeed been a factor behind the economic discomfort felt by the average person in the United States. Now, the basic theory with free trade, my goodness, you open your trade, cut your trade barriers, open free trade with a country that you haven't had before. The theory is that under that circumstance, the internal efficiencies of the two countries will shift back and forth in terms of how products are made and such. But the effect is that where one country is more efficient in one area and the other is more efficient in the other, that the those products will end up being made where it's done most efficiently, and that the overall wealth to the system will be greater than it was before, and that should be a benefit to everyone. And while that's a nice theory, there's a, as with most economic theories that can't address the real world too meaningfully, there are some significant underlying assumptions. And the one there is that both systems are at full employment. We haven't been at full employment in some time, neither have our major trading partners. So in that type of a circumstance, the trade benefit shifts to the low-cost producer, so that with NAFTA, you've had plants moving out of the United States to Mexico, for example. Without people in the U.S. being able to get equivalent paying jobs, we've effectively lost a lot of our productive base over the last couple of decades. And the administrations involved have generally shared the same view here. They've not looked to reverse the trend. Now, there are all sorts of reasons that the U.S. has become non-competitive in global production, but some of the trade deals have helped that. I mean, our wages are higher, and then you look at all the costs of the regulatory system, from the environmental end to the worker protection. Now, those are all fine programs, but when you're competing with countries that don't have those, the cost of those programs, or the manufacturers don't, those manufacturers have a pretty good cost advantage, with the effect that jobs are lost from the United States to those countries, and higher paying jobs are lost. The productive wealth of the country effectively is redistributed to the rest of the world. The policies there have been aimed at doing that, and again, that's one reason that Trump was, I believe, successful in his bid for the presidency, and why he's making a lot of noise about changing trade policy. That's an overhaul that you didn't see in any of the changes in the presidency or party since the first George Bush was in office.
I think you've alluded to this. The NAFTA trade agreement clearly gutted the industrial Midwest, the heartland of the United States. I mean, you can make that argument. Times are changing. I mean, we simply were entering a global system here, as you say, about 20 years ago. It was inevitable, away from an industrial base into obviously an information and financial base, which is coming back to haunt us now. And as you say, we really haven't had an administration to try to reverse this since Ross Perot was running for office, you know, 25, 30 years ago, talking about that great sucking sound. That's the sound of jobs, right, flowing out of the U.S.
Let me put it this way. Mr. Trump, in many ways, appealed to the same voter that Ross Perot did, but the damage in the days of Ross Perot was not quite as bad as it has been since. There are ways there are ways of addressing this, but it's... The primary ways that the recent administrations have addressed this is to play with economic statistics and the way they reported unemployment, as opposed to do anything to meaningfully help the displaced worker.
Well, I'd like to get your thoughts on China, the year of the rooster, and there is some talk that the People's Bank of China and related member banks and even private banks accumulated a vast sum of the yellow metal, gold, in that country, officially no more than 3,000 tons. But according now to several independent services, the number should be as high as 30,000 tons, which would be about threefold the United States and equivalent to really the rest of the world's gold reserves of central banks. Do you have any thoughts on the potential for India and China reversing the demand theme and trends and really boosting overall price for gold and the precious metals in the coming years?
I would certainly be building up gold stores if I had control over it. The issue here, as I see it in the next year, is going to be that you'll face a dollar crisis. With the dollar crisis, you're going to have an inflation crisis in the United States. If you look at the inflation we've had in really since the panic of 2008, the bulk of the shift you've seen in inflation, both up and down, has been tied directly to gasoline prices more than anything else. And the gasoline prices, the oil prices, move inversely with the value of the dollar. If the dollar weakens, Oil prices rise, gasoline prices rise, our domestic inflation rises. You get enough selling of the dollar, you have the early stages of not only a good pickup in inflation, but of the rest of the world is perceiving that the dollar is going to be in decline here. You can see massive dumping of the dollar. You've got, say, $15, $16 trillion of dollar assets outside the U.S. that can be liquidated and dumped in, back into the system, which the Fed's got to absorb, where, again, we'll have all sorts of inflation problems. We're going to have an inflation problem here, generally a debasement of the dollar, and it's a circumstance where I'm still looking at a hyperinflation. I can't give you the specific timing, but I think we're going to move in a big direction that year as the dollar comes under heavy selling pressure and you start to see a strong pickup in inflation. A beneficiary to that would be holding of physical gold and silver. And as such, I think that's the primary hedge going forward for anyone looking to preserve their wealth and assets, and irrespective of who's holding the gold, if you're holding it as well, your fortunes will rise with the precious metal as well. And it's not that you're necessarily your fortunes are rising, it's just that you're not losing the value of your dollar-denominated assets as the dollar becomes worthless.
This is an interesting topic as we see what's unfolding in Venezuela, where you see the beginning stages of a hyperinflation and maybe more appropriately a runaway, at least right now. Yeah, inflation where, you know, anyone who, by the grace of God, had access to gold, of course, they were insulated, but that very small fraction of the populace. And again, you know, fast forward to the United States, of Americans have access to even $1,000 in liquid cash for investing purposes. And how do you see it unfolding? Obviously, a runaway inflation would be dissimilar from Venezuela. Can you give us a scenario?
Once the inflation breaks, if you're looking at something beyond what people have normally seen and expected, you can see all sorts of disruptions in the system. You don't have to hold gold, although gold and silver would provide a fundamental hedge I can think of. But you also should be holding, you know, a couple of months' worth of canned goods, basic supplies that you need to survive. If a hyperinflation hits, indeed, it'll be very disruptive to the system. When such a thing happens, I mean, I can't tell you how the things such as credit cards will function. Suppose you want to take your credit card and go buy groceries, and you have a $5,000 limit on your credit card at the moment, but loaf of bread cost you $5,000. That could become difficult. So the system has to be able to adapt, and I just don't see it happening that quickly. So you're going to see all sorts of unexpected disruptions. You may see disrupted flows of goods to grocery stores. I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen. The only thing I can suggest is that you play it safe. You can buy yourself some relatively cheap insurance just by having a store of goods that you need to get by for a couple of months, as you might with a natural disaster. I live out in California near some major quake faults here, and most people out here have such things to carry them through a major earthquake, and figuring that it'd be a while before there's any great relief from the government. No harm in making a similar assumption about a financial catastrophe, man-made catastrophe that could have the same effect, particularly in an environment where the headline inflation right now is so low, you're still looking at negative interest rates. If you put your money in years' worth of consumable goods that had a shelf life, so you wouldn't be having to throw things out, you'd probably make money on buying them and holding them because of inflation rather than putting your money into a treasury bill or note that would give you negative return. I mean, you don't have to go into gold if you don't have enough to do so, but what you need to do is preserve the ability to get the stuff that will get you through a difficult time. If you hold that, you can afford it with your current cash, then you can still ride out the storm.
Keeping with your earthquake analogy, you know, I think what might even be more appropriate would be a situation where folks aren't expecting an earthquake. For instance, the New Madrid earthquake in the center of the United States in the heartland, which actually reversed the Mississippi River. It was an astounding phenomenon. The parallel, of course, with the economy, we haven't seen a runaway inflation, not even comparable with the 1970s. I mean, we would have to go back to maybe the 1860s or maybe even, you know, the 1700s to find a comparison.
We haven't seen it here. The system now has been run to the brink of what it can do to support itself in the way we've seen it in modern times. We're looking at a circumstance. We've been living beyond our means to the extreme in the last couple of decades. We're looking at something here that'll rival anything seen in the hyperinflations that make the headlines, like the Weimar Republic. Once the people lose confidence in the currency, it's a lost game.
Anyone who has studied even a modicum of history recognizes a cycle here, not just the Western world, but for at least the last several hundred years. Each time this Pandora's box is opened with fiat, it enriches an elite few while impoverishing the overwhelming masses and eventually implodes, leading to, let's keep it euphemistically here, a regime change on a grand scale that decimates the nation where this occurs. Now we have it on a global scale.
Well, I think you make a good point, and we can see this on a scale that's never been seen before, thanks to modern technology and the intertwining of economies on a global basis. In the 1930s, as you had the stock market collapse, we went into the Great Depression. The banking system imploded, basically. A number of banks failed. The Glass-Steagall Act was enacted to try and get around the abuses of the system and separate the commercial banks from the investment banks to prevent things like that from happening again. Well, it was 1999 before the modern system got so strong and everyone real cocky and confident that decided to do away with the Glass-Steagall and created all sorts of new investment instruments that helped to bring down the system in the panic of 2008. But all the elements there were spread globally. The risks were spread globally. Global system on the brink, at least the Western system, where you've had the so-called hard currencies of the euro and the dollar and such. I don't know what would happen here to be fully global, but you certainly have that potential within the former hard currencies.
You know, it's interesting because we've had much more mainstream folks, if you will. I mean, directly from Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, Boston University, widely respected within the establishment or the established economic community. And he's noting evidence of at least $200 trillion in national debt here in the United States, that we're looking at $200 to $220 trillion in unfunded liabilities when it's all added into the national debt. Bottom line, the U.S. is not broke or insolvent 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. It is now and was last year.
Well, he's effectively right. I think the difference is that, if I heard you correctly there, in terms of what he's talking about in the unfunded liabilities, I'm talking about them in terms of net present value, where you discount them for the future value of money. In other words, how much money do you need in hand today to cover those obligations going forward? And you need something in excess of $100 trillion in hand today to cover that. There's no way you have that. I mean, that's more than the global GDP. We have trouble borrowing with our treasury now. So there's no way that can be funded. Now, can it be addressed? Yeah, and we'll see what happens with the new administration. It's not going to be politically popular, but there are ways it can be addressed in terms of Social Security and Medicare. You have to change the programs and the parameters under which they work to make them solvent on a long-term basis. If you don't do that, there's no way of escaping the system, and that's why I'm looking at this year ahead as being particularly difficult for the dollar, because unless that the long-term solvency issues here that are being discussed are addressed, unless they're addressed now, the rest of the world's just going to say, hey, we don't want anything to do with the dollar. They're going to start dumping the dollar. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, as all the dollars that are being held, including the treasuries that are being held, we're already seeing the different central banks cutting back their holdings of U.S. treasuries. Nobody wants to hold the dollar long term. And that's what gives you the rapid decline in the currency, which gives you the rapid inflation here. And that moves you towards a debasement. Nobody wants to hold the dollar. They don't see the system as being solvent long term. And you're off to the races with the hyperinflation. Now, in terms of the ratings downgrade, which would accelerate the process, and that's what Standard & Poor's did back in 2011, that's not quite what triggered that. The crazy thing about these ratings, as I understand them, is that the rating is the risk of, let's say, the United States defaulting on its debt in the next year. If that's nil, then you've got your AAA rating or whatever, the top rating you want to give it. What happened in 2011 was that in the arguments in Congress about raising the debt limit, there was some talk of allowing some default. And it was that talk of the default that triggered the alarm bells within the rating industry, because there, if you have some risk of a default in the next year, you don't have a AAA rating, and that's what caused them to act. If they're looking at a longer term basis, we wouldn't be looking at a AAA rating or a AA rating. That's an area that to watch closely as we get into the year ahead too, because there's going to be I believe there's another debt limit debate coming up, and you have all sorts of factors coming together here with a new government and some new approaches. But if it doesn't go well, it can go very badly very quickly. And again, particularly anything that would threaten the recognition of the long-term solvency of the United States would be absolutely and immediately fundamental in driving the value of the dollar lower.
I'd simply add that in the past, you know, the risk was somewhat subdued relative to now, because there were far fewer alternatives for the players, institutions, and central banks. But fast forward to today, take China in the Middle East, for instance. We're seeing, yes, big shifts in these power schemes, flows of oil, petroleum around the world, numerous agreements under the table, if you will, that really leaves the greenback isolated and I think gives them an opportunity to circumvent the petrodollar agreement. You know, I want to encourage all of our listeners to bookmark shadowstats.com. Just, you won't find it anywhere else. Would you like to highlight some of what folks will have when they sign up for Shadowstats newsletter?
The homepage has some background information, articles on why I'm looking at it, hyperinflation. Some is back from a couple of years ago, but the principles are there. It tells you how to handle it. But in terms of the current detail, what's happening, we put out a weekly newsletter, weekly commentary, at least once a week, goes with economic releases, in which I assess the underlying reality of the economic statistics and update the circumstances on the deficit and the factors that are moving us towards this very difficult time ahead. We publish the headlines of each commentary there, so you at least get a sense of what it's looking at. And I try to price the subscription so that it's not completely out of whack for most people. $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. Always happy to pick up new subscribers. Always happy to address people's questions. Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project,
offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.